Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
And I'm Aaron Mathieu. Thanks so much for joining us. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com as we say goodbye today to the Joe Biden administration, the guy who saved democracy only to preside over a genocide, a horrible proxy war, and to top it all off, went ahead and pardoned his son, Hunter, after saying he wouldn't do that. There's so much to look back on, but we're going to focus today, of course, on what will always be Joe Biden's legacy and that of everyone around him, which is the genocide in Gaza, which fittingly, just as he leaves, there might be, and we can't say for sure, there might be a deal to end this whole thing. There might be.
And, you know, Aaron, I feel like we should give Biden his due. And I feel like you missed a very important element of Biden's legacy, which is, of course, handing the presidency back to Donald Trump, which he did do in large part by overseeing this genocide. And of course, Kamala helped by refusing to stop it. And now we know from polling that was a big factor in people staying home and people who had voted for Biden last time staying home this time. So congrats, Biden. Your legacy is helping destroy Gaza and also not even doing well politically for your own self-interest. And speaking of Democrats sucking and the genocide, let's take a look maybe for the last time, at least for the last time while he's Secretary of State, let's take a look at Antony Blinken during his own farewell address, how he was greeted by people in the audience.
At the same time, we strengthened America's robust sanctions regime on Iran and delivered on President Biden's commitment.
You will forever be known as Bloody Blinken, Secretary of Genocide. You have the blood of hundreds of thousands of innocent people on your hands. We have spent
Thank you. I respect your views. Please allow me to share mine. Thank you.
What she's referring to there is there's been an encampment at Blinken's house for a very long time now with people, you know, sleeping right outside Blinken's home. And every time his motorcade comes in, you know, basically chanting and even spilling fake blood on his vehicle to protest his integral role in facilitating the Israeli genocide. And finally, it is, as you said, it's very fitting as he leaves and gives a sort of farewell address at the Atlantic Council, which is a neocon think tank. He gets confronted by the same people who've been trying to hold him to account for a very long time.
Right. So, yeah, that's an example of Democrats sucking, but I guess the people delivering. And that brave protester who said it extremely well, and let's from here on out, let's definitely call him Bloody Blinken. She wasn't the only one to interrupt him.
Since October 7th.
Where's the lie?
Yeah. I nominate either of those women to be Secretary of State.
I love how in the first clip he says to the protester, he says, I respect your views. Please allow me to share mine.
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, you don't respect their views because you haven't listened to these people at all. You've refused to, you know, engage with calls for a ceasefire. And he's lied about it. He's repeatedly said that it's Hamas that was the obstacle. And everybody now knows that Israel has been the main obstacle, and they've been able to get away with it because Joe Biden and Antony Blinken have supported them. But he says, you know, I respect your views. Like, No, you don't.
You know. Well, I mean, if you do, then it means that you think you're a genocidal maniac. So it would be great if he respected her views. I hope he respects them. He should respect them.
Yeah. I respect your views, and I'm a genocidal maniac. Yes.
Yeah. What do we have for Republican suck?
Well, let's hear from how the Trump administration is responding to the ceasefire. Now, in the Israeli media, they're reporting that basically Trump was instrumental to pushing through this ceasefire, that Trump's incoming Middle East envoy, Stephen Sotloff, was basically very harsh with the Israelis and encouraged them very strongly to accept the ceasefire and was very adamant about that. And so Trump and his camp are taking credit for the ceasefire agreement. And there's been reporting from Gulf states to back that up. But let's hear from the Trump team itself and how it sees this incoming ceasefire, because it doesn't sound pretty much any different from what's been going on all along, which is that Israel insists on the right to use violence against the people of Gaza whenever it wants. So this is Mike Waltz's reaction to the ceasefire. Mike Waltz, the incoming National Security Advisor for Donald Trump.
From your perspective, if this deal goes through and we enter what's characterized as the first phase, does that effectively mean the war is over? Does a ceasefire mean that its work is done in Gaza for the foreseeable future?
Well,
you can tell by the way that this interviewer, he doesn't want that to happen. Like, is the war over? Does this mean Israel's work is done? Please say it ain't so. And right. By work, he means genocide. He wants Israel to keep destroying what's left of Gaza.
Right. There's so much more to do.
Innocent people. Does this mean it's over? Has it come to – please say no, Mike. Please say no. And I think this interviewer is in for a welcome answer from his point of view, from his genocidal point of view.
I certainly think Hamas would like to believe that. But we've been clear that Gaza has to be fully demilitarized. Hamas has to be destroyed to the point that it cannot reconstitute, and that Israel has every right to fully protect itself. So, all of those pieces, all of those objectives are still very much in place. Look, I mean, October 7th was a terrible day. They put everybody in a terrible position, including the Palestinian people of Gaza, whom they regularly hide behind and are willing to sacrifice and have sacrificed for their own sick ends and objectives. And so we need to get our people out, and then we need to achieve those objectives in this war.
And you've said every member of Hamas should be killed. Pete Hegseth today at the confirmation hearing was asked by Senator Cotton something related to Israel, and he said every last member of Hamas should be killed. So from your standpoint, the incoming administration's policy is still Hamas cannot have a role in governing Gaza.
Hamas can't have a role. ISIS doesn't have a role. Al-Qaeda doesn't have a role. No, of course not. And it astounds me that people try to put them in some type of special category. These are hostage-taking, murderous, rapist torturers that never should ever have any role in governing. Some will try to kind of point to the practicality. I don't think any of that is practical. None of it's acceptable. And we shouldn't subject the Palestinian people to that either. We shouldn't sell them short. They're, look, many of them, as we know, have been brainwashed. But we'll never get to a better future. We'll never get to a truly stable region if we don't carve out this cancer.
Some strange comments there. First of all, he says that, Al-Qaeda isn't acceptable as a ruler of Gaza. Al-Qaeda isn't in Gaza. They are in Syria. The head of Syria right now is the former leader of Al-Qaeda in Syria. But the U.S. has accepted him because he served the goal of regime change in Syria, which is why the U.S. backed the Al-Qaeda-dominated insurgency. But anyway, that's just a side point. But it sounds like basically Mike Waltz is endorsing a continuation of Israel's current policy just after they get out their remaining captives inside Gaza. So basically, the ceasefire means we get out all of the Israeli hostages, and then we let Israel continue to carry out aggression against the people of Gaza. And by the way, calling Hamas rapists and saying that that's a reason why they shouldn't be allowed to rule. Well, if that was the case, then Israel would not be allowed to rule, because not only is it presiding over a military occupation, there's been documented cases now of Israeli military forces carrying out rape. And whereas the allegation against Hamas militants for rape is still unproven, it's been lodged. Israel blocked another UN commission because they didn't want them to investigate this, because that would have opened up Israel to more scrutiny over its documented rape of Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, it's just stunning. We've mentioned this a bunch, but the fact that they're not talking about the documented rape of Palestinians, which was covered by Israeli media, is just stunning, and tells us that they don't care about rape or sexual abuse. They just care about weaponizing narratives. And it's disgusting. Well, for Isn't That Weird, we have a shocking expose brought to us by the amazing journalists at the New York Post. And of course, as always, they have an amazing headline to go with it. And it says, "Cushion for the pushin'. Biden sits on pillow to boost himself up during farewell address." And I'm just going to read a little bit of it. "He needs all the support he can get. President Biden sat on a pillow for an extra boost as he delivered his 18-minute farewell address to the nation from the Oval Office Wednesday night. Photos taken from just outside the Oval Office show the 82-year-old commander-in-chief with the small cushion wedged between the presidential rump and the seat of the seemingly firm leather chair." How does that, what do they mean, by the way, just outside the Oval Office? Like, they were standing outside the Oval Office and they managed to get footage of inside the Oval Office? I guess that's a good camera. And then if you scroll down, it says the images also show an emergency box of tissues and glass of water placed to Biden's right, invisible below his desk from the front view cameras that streamed his speech to the nation. And then, of course, there's a close-up of that. And I guess, yeah, it is a pretty good shot. If you scroll down and you look at the other photos, it looks like they were outside the Oval Office, but they did manage to get that very, very good shot, and they managed to really not have a lot of reflection. So shout out to that photographer. But I just thought it was interesting, because that's not really the most scandalous thing, of course, about Biden. There's so many more scandalous things about him. I just think it's kind of weird that it's kind of weird of the Post to do a piece about this as if it's at all relevant or important. Nothing wrong with having water or tissues. I just do think that it is weird, though, that he was the president, that he oversaw this genocide, and that the Post is bothering posting stuff like this.
The New York Post supports the genocide, so that's why they have to other areas of disagreement and other scandals and mishaps, including sitting on a pillow to boost his posture. You know, I did think what was funny about Biden's speech is that he warned at the end. I think he was trying to emulate Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex. And so he warned about this new class of tech oligarchs who are billionaire oligarchs who are, you know, increasingly running our society and eroding democracy. He's talking about Elon Musk. And he's right. You know, it is a serious problem. But it's just funny that he's pretending as if he's against billionaire oligarchs when he was, of course, like a devoted servant of them throughout his many years in public office. But
yes, he did, as you say, Aaron, he was clearly signaling the industrial military complex speech of Eisenhower. He called it a tech industrial complex.
By which he means Elon Musk, and simply because Elon Musk is not on his team. Like, if Elon Musk was on Biden's team, there's no way he'd be warning right now about a tech industrial complex. He'd be singing its praises.
Right. Yeah. And this tech industrial complex is obviously a real thing, and it's something that people are worried about. So you have Anna Cabrera, who's at MSNBC. She tweets out, "Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and Jeff Bezos will attend President-elect Trump's inauguration. An official involved with the planning of the inauguration tells NBC. They will be seated on the inaugural platform close to nearby cabinet officials and elected leaders, according to the official." Okay, so what's the response to that from Obama bro and Biden booster and podcast boy Jon Favreau? Let's see. He says, "The era of government of, by, and for the billionaires has begun." And guys, this is on January 14th that this has begun, apparently. but, you know, there's one other tweet that I think is helpful in this analysis, if we're going to try to trace back where this begins. And this is something that Rohan Gray, who's a lawyer, tweeted out. Let's take a look at this. And he tweets, "Oh, come the F on," and shows this image of Richard Branson and Obama, suggesting that this image, of course, which precedes 2025, signs signals that this technocracy oligarchy was in existence before, and this billionaire political alignment was in existence before. And of course it was. That's one of the first things he did after leaving the presidency. Now, the thing that I will say about Trump is that in some ways it's a relief. In some ways it's helpful because he makes these alliances so clear and so stark while the Democrats try to hide them.
Recall with Obama, he staffed his cabinet with people who are basically selected by Citibank. Rather than respond to the financial crisis by punishing Wall Street, he basically bailed them out. Right. And punish average workers and homeowners. That was Obama. So to claim now that, like, now we're in the era of a government run by billionaires, it's pretty rich. It's pretty rich. I mean, it's true when it comes to Trump and his gang. And Elon Musk does have a really, I think, dangerous role. And it's ridiculous. But he's just making plain what was already the case under Democrats. And very fitting for Biden to pretend as if now all of a sudden that era has begun when he's been presiding over it.
Right.
Isn't that terrible? Let's turn to Jonathan Greenblatt. He is the head of something called the Anti-Defamation League, which pretends to be a crusader against discrimination when really, in real life, all it does is attack anybody who supports Palestinian rights. And he was recently in Israel giving a speech on the fight against anti-Semitism. And in laying out how this fight should be waged, he drew some pretty odd inspiration. So let's hear what he said.
Maybe it's a whole new IDF unit, call it 8300, to lead this fight. But we need the kind of genius that manufactured Apollo gold pagers and infiltrated Hezbollah for over a decade to prepare for this battle. We need the kind of courage that executed Operation Deep Layer inside Syria and destroyed Iranian missile manufacturing capabilities to undertake this mission. This is the kind of ingenuity and inventiveness that have always been a hallmark of the State of Israel, that have always been a characteristic of the Jewish people. I know we can do it.
So what he's saying is terrorism. We need terrorism to combat anti-Semitism. That's what the pager attack was. So Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, is officially calling for terrorism against people who he deems to be anti-Semitic, which in real life just means people who are protesting genocide and opposed to apartheid in Israel. Comments like this should land him on a terror watch list, but of course they don't. They land him invites to, you know, galas in Washington, D.C. and being hauled before Congress to testify as some sort of expert on anti-Semitism. And really, what he is, he's fomenting terrorism.
And to be fair, I mean, it's a nice callback to how Israel was founded through terrorism.
That's true. It is consistent. It's very, very consistent. Yeah.
Well, those are your four basic food groups.
If you asked our critics, they'd tell you that Useful Idiots is a secret agent podcast funded by foreign governments. But you listen to Useful Idiots. You know we're American made. And at a time when it feels like most of our money is being sent overseas to fund weapons dealers, we want to show some support for a company that's doing their best to give good jobs to American workers and really good clothes too. It's American Giant. And since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic Full Zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. Check out the premium Slub Crew Tee, the No BS high-rise pant, and the slim roughneck pant featured in Giant Magazine. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes, and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. Code USEFUL.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For this week's interview, we'll be hearing from two guests, Daniel Levy and Mohammed Shahada, on the potential ceasefire deal in Gaza. And I say potential because you never know. Israel is already claiming that Hamas is standing in the way, and they've delayed a vote on actually implementing the ceasefire deal by the Israeli cabinet. So we have to be cautious in hoping that the ceasefire will actually take effect. But before we get to our guests, let's hear once again from Secretary of State Antony Blinken. And this is a fitting way, I think, to introduce this segment, because the theme of this interview is basically that the U.S. was critical in delaying a ceasefire deal that could have been reached so long ago. The terms, as we're going to hear Mohammed Shahada explain, of the ceasefire deal are basically identical to what was reached many, many months ago. But the Biden administration, and specifically Antony Blinken, whose job it is to be a diplomat, stood in the way and basically did Israel's bidding and accepted Israel every time it added new conditions that made a ceasefire deal impossible. And so Antony Blinken was at the State Department on Thursday giving a farewell news conference. And what he thought, I think, would be a sort of a warm affair and maybe expecting to be praised for finally achieving the ceasefire deal that has been missing for the last year plus of genocide. But instead, he was confronted. He was confronted by some very brave journalists who reminded him of his real legacy in Gaza, which is genocide. So first, let's hear from Max Blumenthal, who stood up and said this to Antony Blinken.
I have even greater respect, even greater appreciation for you asking the tough questions, for you holding us to account, being on the receiving end. Sometimes that's not always the most comfortable thing, not always the most enjoyable thing, but it is the most necessary thing.
300 reporters in Gaza were on the receiving end of your bombs. Why did you keep the bombs flowing when we had a deal in
May? I'm happy to address
questions. We all knew we had a deal. Everyone in this room knows we had a deal, Tony, and you kept the bombs flowing.
I'm happy to address questions.
Why did you sacrifice the rules-based order on the mantle of your commitment to Zionism? Why did you allow my friends to be massacred? Why did you allow my friends' homes in Gaza to be destroyed when we had a deal in May? You helped destroy our religion, Judaism, by associating with fascism.
Yeah, I have a statement to make.
You waved the white flag before Netanyahu.
We'll have the time to take questions at the end.
You waved the white flag before Israeli fascism.
I look forward to taking questions when I get a chance to finish my statement.
Your father-in-law was an Israel lobbyist. Your grandfather was an Israel lobbyist. Are you compromised by Israel? Why did you allow the Holocaust of our time to happen? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? You too, Matt. You smirk through the whole thing every day.
Thank
you. Smirk through a genocide.
Thank you.
And for our audio audience at the end, that's Max confronting State Department spokesperson. Some people call him Count Smirkala,
right?
Matt Miller. And as Max tells them, you smirk through a genocide. But those last questions from
and
Max.
He's literally smirking, by the way, when he says
he's
that.
Smirking, yeah. Those last questions to Blinken, how does it feel that your legacy will be genocide? How could you allow the Holocaust of our time? Those are the key questions to ask of Blinken, and they're not questions that he's received from the press corps. And that's why I think Max felt compelled to take the very unusual step in a State Department briefing of interrupting a Secretary of State. But when you preside over a Holocaust, I think normal rules of decorum and civility go out the window because the rules of basic international law have been discarded. So I don't think Antony Blinken deserved the respect that is normally given to a top diplomat in a press room, because we're talking about someone who facilitated mass murder and has gotten very little pushback over it from the media, if at all. So that was Max Blumenthal. And then also there also was Sam Husseini, who also posed questions of Antony Blinken and was removed from the room. And this clip we're going to see is CNN's coverage of Sam Husseini's interaction with Antony Blinken. And it's interesting to see how CNN, which has, of course, refused to hold these officials to account for genocide, how they react to a journalist actually doing what they've refused to do.
And we have, I think, video of another angle of what happened there in the press room at the State Department. Let's watch.
Do you talking about Israel's nuclear weapons, everybody from the ICJ, I was sitting here quietly, and now I'm being manhandled by two or three people. You pontificate about a free press. You pontificate about...
By the way, just for people who are not watching and just listening, the Chyron says, Blinken news conference repeatedly interrupted by man asking questions about U.S. policy in Gaza. Not by a journalist. Okay.
A free press. You are hurting me. You are hurting me. You are hurting me. I am asking questions after being told by Matt Miller that he will not answer my questions until I'm asking questions. Wasn't the point of May 31st statement to block the ICJ orders? You blocked the ICJ orders.
Please, sir, respect the process.
Respect the process. Respect the process. Well, everybody from Amnesty International, from Amnesty International to the ICJ, saying that Israel's doing genocide and extermination, and you're telling me to respect the process. Criminal! Why aren't you in the Hague? Why aren't you in the Hague? Why aren't you about Israel?
Wow.
So I can't speak to who that was. What I will say is that, you know, over the past few years.
And the CNN anchor went on to describe this as cringe-worthy heckling. Well, you know, one might say that a network that whitewashes mass murder, I mean, cringe-worthy would be a polite way to describe it. It's a good contrast. People in the press room trying to hold Biden and Blinken to account, which is just so rare. It almost never happens. And then you see the reaction there of CNN, which is to take offense at people trying to ask, you know, decent questions based on being humane of an outgoing Secretary of State. So what a fitting way to end Anthony Blinken's tenure and a good way to introduce this segment with our two guests.
We're so excited to be speaking to Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project and former Israeli peace negotiator under Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. And we are also really honored to be speaking to Mohammed Shahada, who is a writer and analyst from Gaza.
Daniel Levy, thank you so much for joining us. As we're recording this, a ceasefire deal has been announced, but already Israel is suggesting that it won't be implemented. The Israeli government says that Hamas is standing in the way of the full implementation of the agreement. And one of the sticking points is Israel's apparent insistence that it retains control over the Philadelphia corridor inside of Gaza. What is your understanding of the obstacles that Israel is still putting in the way of implementing the ceasefire agreement that most people think is set in stone?
We've been told different things, some to do with what you mentioned on the Philadelphia corridor, others on the list of Palestinian prisoners who Israel would release. I think if one cuts through it, it's a lot more simple. Netanyahu is precisely where he didn't want to be in all this time. Yeah, we were told Hamas was the holdout. It's really rare, actually, to have near unanimity in Israel, in the political class and amongst the commentariat, pro and anti Netanyahu, as to what has been going on here. And they're all saying Netanyahu was the holdout. Now, some are saying, and rightly so, but that's the understanding. Ben-Gvir has owned, you know, the minister Ben-Gvir has owned that he had prevented a deal from happening earlier. So if you cut through everything, and I think. Now, as of when we're talking, it actually seems that they're no longer claiming there are outstanding issues. This Philadelphia route, for instance, it's there in the text. It's day 50, I think, that they have to complete the withdrawal from Philadelphia. What we are seeing is Netanyahu in a bind, and he's still looking. What are my options for getting out of this? Is one of the options for this simply not to see the light of day? If not, is my option to have Trump world lean on my right-wing ministers, perhaps, or to try and bring them back in so that I don't lose my coalition? If not, do I try and get out of this while trying to heap the blame on Hamas as soon as possible? So that's the dynamic. The dynamic that Netanyahu least wants is the smooth implementation, and certainly the continued implementation right through to the end, because the things that entails, that's written down there, the permanent ceasefire, the withdrawal of the IDF, those are all things that the Israeli side has still said they will not do. And this idea that it's been a stunning victory is just not resonating in Israel. It's really interesting. I've never seen an Israeli elite and Israeli political class, commentariat class, so unwilling to buy the hype. They're not, of course, leaning into the things that we might talk about in terms of the, you know, Hamas from there, you know, what has happened to people in Gaza. It's not that they're showing concern for that, but they are saying Hamas is still there. There was no total victory. 15 Israelis in northern Gaza in the last week, Israeli soldiers killed. We don't have a solution for what happens next in Gaza. So there is a serious sense of that something's not gone right here.
And for Netanyahu, what would keep him, like, what is his main motive in wanting to not abide by this own ceasefire deal that he just signed on to? Is it mainly political that he loses the support of the extreme right ministers like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich if he actually implements this agreement?
So I think it's a couple of things. First of all, you know, this is the same deal that he didn't want to sign on to for 8 months. So one can get a sense of his appetite for it, right? He knows now that his coalition is not the stable thing it has been for the first 2 years of his government. And that's huge, Aaron, right? The guys in court, this is his literal get-out-of-jail card to stay in power. He needs a coalition to do so. Sure, he could lean on a safety net from the so-called centrist parties, but they're not going to keep him in power forever. So if he loses his coalition, that's elections. And in no poll is he going to win those elections. But beyond that, also as part of his political survival strategy, has been the idea of Netanyahu as wartime leader. He has reinvented himself as the leader who is going to just resolve these issues. Now, in that respect, he will claim a better track record, given what he can say about the weakening of Hezbollah in Lebanon. I don't think he had much to do with it at all, but the removal of the Assad regime. And in that respect also, let's not forget that whatever happens in Gaza in the coming weeks, Israel is still in sovereign Lebanese territory and is still bombing Lebanon. Israel is still beyond the already illegally occupied and annexed Golan. Israel is in parts of Syrian territory and is bombing Syria. Israel will, of course, continue, and I would imagine intensify its destructive actions in the West Bank, perhaps provocations in East Jerusalem as well. And that's without discussing Iran. So the second thing is here, Bibi wants to be the wartime leader, right? And Gaza was a big piece of this, and he doesn't want. You see, once this is done, a few things happen, one of which is people go back to, how did this happen in the first place? Why haven't you achieved what you said you were going to achieve? What about the commissions of inquiry? If the military folk now are going to take responsibility and step down, why aren't you stepping down? So all those things, politically, he has sought to avoid. And then one can also talk about the ideological. I don't think Netanyahu actually leads the charge to resettle Gaza, but that's certainly something that resonates not only with the parties of Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, but also very much inside his own Likud movement.
Regardless of what happens moving forward, what does this teach us about Biden? What do these events prove about Biden and what he could have done and chose not to do, et cetera?
Well, let's, if I may, just expand it out a little, because I think we have to throw Blinken, right, Sullivan, McGurk, and a host of others into the mix when we're talking about that. For me, what it tells us is this is the same Netanyahu who is actually relatively easily pressured. There was a hard choice you could have placed Netanyahu in front of. Now, I do think that the person of Trump, the way he is perceived, this unpredictability, that means it's easier for Trump to have this impact on people where they say, yeah, I better be careful how I handle this. But that doesn't absolve Biden from the fact that he had tremendous leverage. He chose not to use it. We've been through this territory. They provided the arms, they provided the funding, they provided the diplomatic, political, legal cover. They ran interference with Israel as much as possible in the international arena, and they aligned with Israel's narrative. And, you know, sometimes in diplomacy, to get a deal across the finishing line, you need some constructive ambiguity, okay? And so maybe, you know, with a wink and a nod, yes, Israel has defeated and won, even though Blinken himself actually acknowledged that Hamas has replenished its ranks. right? So, but that's not what happened. They actually protected Netanyahu. Even when you had these occasional peaks of pressure on Netanyahu from his security establishment, from his own defense minister, another guy on charges of war crimes, let's remember, it was the Americans, it was Blinken who stood after his meeting with Netanyahu and said Netanyahu has accepted the deal. Everyone knew he was lying through his teeth. So what it tells you is that those people were not just ineffective, but so callous, so inhumane. And I'll say two other things. What they did with your American taxpayer dollars. So they spent billions in sending the weapons for Israel to destroy everything. They sent a few hundreds of millions, perhaps, in trying to make up on some of the huge damage that was done. Of course, those lives of people can never be returned. And at the same time, they spent some extra billions telling us, well, we've got to bomb Yemen as well. We're going to bomb the Houthis because that's the only way to keep sea lanes clear. Even though the Houthis were telling us, we'll stop. And they've now affirmed that, right? The Houthi statement. Like, where are we when the statement of the Houthis is so much more credible than anything the American Secretary of State is saying? And the other thing I think they showed us, because these lies were so transparent, because there was such a contempt for their listening and ultimately voting public, I think that also tells us a story that the election also told us. When you treat people with contempt, I don't know, for some reason, they don't find it all that attractive to vote for you or your vice president. Who would have thunk it?
Well, on that note, Daniel, what do you make of Trump taking credit for the ceasefire? He's bragging about the fact that Israeli officials, Gulf state officials have all said that it was the intervention of the Trump team that made the difference. All these reports about Trump's Middle East envoy, Stephen Witkoff, being very harsh and direct with the Israelis and that sort of forcing them to come to the table. It's easy to believe that based on how timid the Biden team was, as you've been talking about, how they put no pressure at all on Israel. At the same time, though, you know, could this also just be Netanyahu doing a favor for his friend Trump, who, you know, many believe he wanted to win the election? And could this then lead to a quid pro quo down the line where Netanyahu gets something from Trump that will be, horrific for Palestinians, such as expanded theft of West Bank land?
So I don't think there's a contradiction there. I think it can and it is likely to be all of those things. First, you know, that point is really important, that the extent of the uselessness of the outgoing administration kind of puts everything else, has to be set against that backdrop. So I don't think it took very much for Trump to say, hey, there's a new reality here. Now, I think some of the stories around Witkoff have probably been embellished. There's a bit of poetic license here. But I think what has gone on is that Netanyahu has looked at it and said, Trump is not going to be a problem for greater Israel. He's not going to be a problem for a continuation of egregious criminal acts of horror against Palestinians. But he might be a problem for my personal political equities. When it comes to how I manage my politics, I knew how to play the other guys. But Trump, I think, is capable of, and I actually do think he's shown it in this instance, of saying, wait a minute, I've met some of these hostage families. I've met some of the Americans. I want to get these people home. I want that achievement. Surely the prime minister wants to get his people out. This is what it takes to get his people out. So why aren't we doing this? Now, what that doesn't mean is that Bibi won't get all those other things. But I haven't yet heard anything on a list of what are the goodies Bibi could get that he wouldn't get anyway from a Trump administration. This is the point. He didn't think that he would have to pay in any currency when it came to doing this deal in order to get, what, more settlements, more land confiscation, a bigger attack on the ICC, more weapons. What's the thing that Trump can give him that he wasn't going to give him anyway, given everything we know about that administration, about the GOP ecosystem, about the track record of Trump? And so I think the shock to the system on the Israeli side is that maybe there are things where America says, actually, that shouldn't be in your interest anyway, by the way, but it sure isn't in ours. So you do all this bad stuff, but we don't expect you to do this.
Did you predict this, by the way, the shift?
I wasn't sure. I mean, I did predict that under Trump, Bibi would have to recalibrate. And what I saw was, and what I think many of us saw, was Bibi was preparing the political ground for possibly having to do a deal because of that Trump factor. And of course, we weren't seeing that with what Biden brought to the table.
So we know that Trump is motivated by opportunism, not by any, you know, respect for human rights or solidarity with the Palestinian people, obviously. But what is motivating Biden here and Blinken, as you rightly point out?
You know, there are certain places I don't want to put my head and into what's between Blinken. Look, Biden, if he hadn't supported such murderous policies, one might almost feel sorry for someone who, even in that last, that last appearance as president, turned around and said, "I spoke to the Emir of Kuwait rather than Qatar." You know, it's pathetic. But when it comes to Blinken, I don't want to put myself in that space. But what I will say is, very unsurprisingly, they have internalized a view of Israel which bears no resemblance to reality. You know, they have gone out and lied for Israel, or they think they're lying for Israel. I think this has been disastrous for Israel, by the way. I mean, it's been disastrous for America, disastrous for Israel. I think the consequences for Israel will be felt for an awfully long time. They've also bought into a certain reading of American domestic politics. And when it comes to Blinken and some of them, the conclusion I'm drawing for myself is there an extra level of cut-offness, of total distanciation from your own voting public, your own constituency, but also from the people whose lives you are impacting over there, right? When you're in the foreign policy blob. Because I think if you do domestic policy, at some stage you have to confront the real problems of real people, even if you come up with fake solutions to those real problems. But I think in foreign policy establishment, you often don't even have to do that. It was noticeable for me that Blinken, when he gave that speech at the Atlantic Council, whatever it was, where he set out, this is the record on the Middle East, he had to quote from a film to talk about the experiences of Palestinian children. Go back and look at that. He literally couldn't speak to personal experiences of Palestinian children from Gaza. And so I think, the extent to which they are distant from the people whose lives they impact so massively, whose deaths they have brought about with their own actions, that's as far as I can go. I do hope that this is something that will hound, not because they have a conscience, but because they are forced to confront it in any public space within the limits of the law. But there should not be easy sinecures and easy speeches and easy spaces for Blinken to go and feel, I can do my thing of being the former Secretary of State. You're someone who should, in a society that cared about the law, not be able to go and do those things because of what you have done. I don't really like him.
Really?
That comes across.
Yeah, I know. I realize.
Yeah.
It.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Dan Levy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this was great.
Thanks very much.
That was Daniel Levy, and now we are speaking to Mohammed Shahada. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thanks again for having me. It's been a long time, Aaron and Kiri. Good to be back.
Thanks for joining. Really excited to talk to you. You have so many incredible insights, observations, analyses, and you actually just wrote a fascinating piece called The Biden Administration's False History of Ceasefire Negotiations. And this is based on actual interviews and research that you did. Can you talk about how this article came about and what you discovered?
It basically, since October 7th, I've suffered from an acute syndrome called the Forrest Gump syndrome. Always the wrong guy at the right place. I found myself in a lot of roundtable discussions and workshops and meetings behind closed doors, where you get some very exclusive and unique insight that is very schizophrenic from what we're hearing in the media, and also enormously enraging. I tried early on to regularly tweet about these things. I tried to write about it from time to time and raise the alarm in different ways behind closed doors. But then a friend approached Matt Duss and said that you need to put it and group it in one place that we can point to and say, look, this is the full history of the whole thing. And that's when I started working on it immediately. Basically, if you look at the record, I've studied it very intimately, dozens of hours of conversations with Arab mediators, with Palestinian negotiators, with Israeli former officials, very senior former officials from the security establishment, from the military, from the government, etc. The image that you get is absolutely insane. It's like nothing I've ever seen in my entire life. So for the first 5 months of the genocide in Gaza, there was an American clear commitment, an American clear ban on the use of the word ceasefire. Nobody was allowed to use it. If you remember Justin Trudeau twisting in pretzels when he's trying to use an alternative, but there's no synonyms for ceasefire, and he's trying really hard and he's contorting in pain, and then he jumps to the word pause. That was the only one the White House was allowing its allies to use.
Pause was acceptable?
Yep, you are only allowed to speak about a temporary pause. Bernie Sanders, with all his passion and fervor and his impassioned speeches, very powerful, very strong. And then every time he speaks very strongly about Gaza, he's like, and that's why I demand in Gaza immediately a pause with his head down. So you saw it on everyone struggling to wanting to say ceasefire, but they're not allowed to. It was frightening to see that kind of spectacle, the same all around the European Union. Even people like Josep Borrell, whose heart is in the topic, he cares about it very deeply. So first 5 months, you're not allowed to mention ceasefire. By February and March, there was a leeway to use the word sustainable calm. That was basically the White House loosening up the ban, sustainable calm. And they were offering it on repeat for Hamas to bite the bait of a temporary pause to get hostages out and then bomb Gaza a thousandfold as vicious as the bombardment was before. Because let's face it, the Israeli crowds that were protesting on the street demanding a ceasefire or a deal, if the hostages came out, the overwhelming majority will be joining the opposite demonstrations, demanding that the war continues until Gaza is no more. So basically, by April, the United States reaches the conclusion that Israel cannot defeat Hamas. Israel could not bring down Hamas militarily or Hamas in government or Hamas as a political group. And the fighting has exhausted itself and it's became very costly for Israel. And there is an imminent threat of a regional war, and that Hamas is not going to accept a temporary pause, no matter how much sort of lucrative enticement you try to throw at it. So the United States present a proposal with Egypt and Qatar proposing a three-phase ceasefire that would lead eventually to the end of the war. And that proposal is presented in early April. By that time, Netanyahu immediately jumps to the scene and tries everything possible to sabotage it. He leaked sensitive intelligence information to Bezalel Smotrich to defame and vilify the ceasefire negotiations, to destroy it from the bud. He restricted the mandate of Israel's negotiating team. Can you imagine the chief of Israel's Mossad, the top spying intelligence agency? Netanyahu sends him with a clear order. You're not allowed to open your mouth. You're just sit and listen. Don't respond to anything. Sit and listen. And then Netanyahu takes another step. He sends with him literally a babysitter. Arab officials put it exactly this way, saying he sent a babysitter, a guy called Ofir Falk from Netanyahu's office, who was there to monitor the chief of the Mossad and General Nitzan alone to make sure they're not going to speak, they're not going to present anything. So he tried everything possible to destroy it, with Biden never calling him out. Mediators, Israeli negotiators, and other concerned parties were begging the Biden administration to name and shame Netanyahu. And he never did. That proposal is presented. Netanyahu tries everything to ruin it. He keeps saying that there will not be an end of the war. There will be a Rafah invasion. There will be a continuity of the genocide. It's like as if he's warning Hamas, don't accept that deal, don't fall for that deal. But Hamas accepts it. They say yes to the deal on May 6th. The day after, Netanyahu immediately invades Rafah, May 7th. Biden had been threatening that the invasion of Rafah has a red line. If Israel crosses it, there will be an immediate suspension of weapon supplies to Israel. Israel invades Rafah. Biden does absolutely nothing. Basically, I asked a senior American or veteran American diplomat, recently retired American ambassador to the Middle East, who's been in touch with the Biden administration. And I said, okay, what went wrong? Why did Biden do nothing about Netanyahu violating his red line? And then he went through a process of mental gymnastics. He said, well, basically, Israel is launching only a limited incursion. It's not an invasion. And I said, no, they're sending 6 battalions, that's thousands of soldiers. He said, yeah, maybe, but they're still carrying out the operation in a limited manner. And I said, no, they're burning out every single home on the way, knocking down every building on the way with bulldozers. And he said, yes, but it's still in a limited area of Rafah. It's not in all of it. And I said, no, they reached the very heart of the city. Israeli tanks are rolling in the heart of Rafah. There's only one street that was left, Tal al-Sultan. If they invaded, they took all of Rafah. And then he says, yeah. But they didn't do to Rafah what they did to Khan Yunis yet. Khan Yunis was wiped out. So basically, he kept redrawing the red line. And then when I cornered him, I said, okay, what went wrong in one sentence? He said, what went wrong is Biden put a red line in the first place. Not that Biden did not enforce the red line, but that he dared to put a red line. He said, if Biden puts any red line in place, Netanyahu will violate it. And Biden knows this. That's what we saw with the 30-day notice in November about allowing humanitarian aid to go in. So Hamas accepts, Netanyahu rejects, destroys the deal. Biden, Israel's team, they formulate, articulate a new proposal that embraces Hamas's demands in their acceptance letter. And that was presented on May 27th. That proposal was given to Netanyahu by his own negotiators. He threw it in the garbage. He said, you don't know how to negotiate. So they went to Biden instead, begging for help from the Americans to come to their aid and announce this as a Biden proposal, which Biden did on the 31st of May. So that was endorsed by the Security Council. Hamas accepts it on the 2nd of July. Netanyahu immediately imposes conditions that his own generals, 4 conditions, his own generals and chief of staff and defense minister were saying are there deliberately to prevent a ceasefire, to render the possibility of a deal impossible, that Hamas would never agree to it. It's ludicrous. It's unimplementable. One of them was restricting and banning the return of 1 million displaced Gazans to the north, that northern Gaza should be just an empty howling wilderness. The other one was basically that Israel maintains the Netzarim corridor, the buffer zone, Philadelphia. That's 33% of Gaza's area. Another one was Israel resuming the war after only 42 days of a pause, no ceasefire. And the last was demanding a list of all the living hostages in Gaza so that Israel can reduce the price, to which Hamas said this is logistically impossible because Hamas's chains of command and control were dismantled. It became largely autonomous for each cell to operate on its own. And because of the amount of surveillance on top of Gaza, any attempt to communicate with people on the ground compromises the whereabouts of those people. And Israel will bomb them immediately on the spot, even if it means killing hostages. So that's basically it. Netanyahu insists on these conditions. In August, the Americans launched what was called the bridging proposal, a new round of negotiations, which was the worst fraud I've ever seen in my entire life. Basically, they issued a positive statement saying there is a breakthrough, that the two sides have managed to close down the gaps, and that everything is going perfectly well. That statement was issued jointly with Qatar and Egypt. But the only problem is that Hamas's delegation never showed up. They didn't even attend the talks. There were no talks to begin with. I was in Doha at the time, and I knew exactly where the Hamas negotiators are. They were not anywhere near the area where the Americans and the Israelis and the Qataris and the Egyptians were sitting to negotiate. So Israelis were talking to themselves. The Americans embraced all of Netanyahu's 4 conditions and packaged it as a bridging proposal. Hamas said, we accepted the deal that was endorsed by the UN Security Council. If you stick to that, we will stick to it. If you try anything else to get us stuck in endless negotiations or just a scam, we're not going to go ahead with it. Qatar and Egypt and Israel were frustrated with this fake positivity because they said it absolves Netanyahu. It removes all pressure from him. The American counter argument was basically, no, if we say everything is going well, there would be more pressure in Israel on Netanyahu to seal the deal. Just stupefying narcissists. The other talking point, which was the actual reason, is that if we issue a statement of positivity, it would hold back a retaliation from Hezbollah against the assassination of their top commander, Fuad Shukr, a few days before, or from Iran against the assassination of Hamas's top negotiator and top leader, Ismail Haniyeh, in Tehran. So they wanted to hold back the Iranians and Hezbollah, tie their hands behind their backs. And the last element, they wanted Kamala Harris's DNC to pass without a hitch, so that people can stand on stage and say, look, Kamala Harris is trying her best. There are negotiations in Qatar, and there were none to begin with. Ever since, there was no attempt to negotiate anymore. The U.S. stopped any attempt to pressure Netanyahu since April. No more attempts to talk sense to the Israelis. It was just leaving the Israelis to their own devices if they would like a deal or not. So by October, that's when you have the Arab mediators themselves saying behind closed doors, quote, the only way you can get a ceasefire is dragging Israel kicking and screaming into one. There's no other way around it. By November, Qatar gets fed up. They decide to shut down Hamas's office, suspended it. That was the sort of the formal terminology. They suspended Hamas's office, said it no longer serves its purpose. They withdrew from their role as mediators, and they sent all of Hamas's leaders one after the other out of Qatar, out of Doha, which is always Israel's talking point, is if Qatar and Egypt pressure Hamas strong enough, Hamas will capitulate. They did. They kicked them out. As soon as that happens, that's when Trump jumps into the picture and his team demand from the Qataris to re-invite all of Hamas's leadership back to Doha to open a new round of negotiations in early December. For the entire month of December, negotiations were just stuck in a limbo, rotating in an empty circle. Netanyahu was unserious about it. By early January, that's when Netanyahu gets a clear sign from Trump's team that Trump wants a deal done before his inauguration, and he means it. And when he says all hell to pay, he means Israel as well in that statement. And that's when Netanyahu immediately accepts it.
What was the most surprising thing to you when you were looking into this?
That was the compulsive. It was like uncontrollable, the compulsive habit of Biden and Blinken to repeat in every statement that Israel accepted, Hamas rejected. Israel's own negotiators were livid with that statement. Their own negotiators said that Blinken's statement of this sort threw a wrench in the negotiations and collapsed them. It killed them at that time. So that was one of the most insane things ever, is how can this guy sit with a straight face and lie through his teeth time and time again, when you know so easily that this has been exposed even in Israeli media, even by Israeli officials, and he still keeps a straight face about it. I've never seen anything like this.
One of the things that you wrote in your piece that I found shocking, it opens early on in the piece, you write, at a workshop in Geneva in November, a recently retired U.S. ambassador who had just returned from meeting White House officials claimed there are currently 3 ceasefire deals on the table and Hamas isn't responding to any of them, end quote. The veteran diplomat acknowledged the suffering in Gaza, but blamed it on Hamas's rejection of an agreement to end the war. Then you go on, to my surprise, a former senior Israeli security official in the room rushed to challenge this claim, which he described as a, quote, shameful attempt to rewrite history and blame Hamas rather than Netanyahu for the obstruction of ceasefire talks, end quote. So you have a former U.S. ambassador being more deferential towards Netanyahu and being more dishonest about Hamas than you have actual former Israeli officials.
Yeah, precisely. That was the other maddening thing, is that American former diplomat, veteran diplomat, is decent on a personal level, and he believed it very deeply in his heart. He did not question it at all. He said, that's what people at the White House told me. That's what career diplomats at the State Department told me. Those people, it's impossible that they're lying to me. They're not lying. He meant it, and he said it sympathetically, because at these workshops, it basically goes like this. It's a sort of a fancy hotel with a 3-course fancy meal, and they asked me to kick off the discussion by describing all the death, starvation, and agony that's going in Gaza, and then bon appetit, enjoy your food. So I usually try to, because Our European colleagues, American colleagues, are easily shocked. So I try to not to give them a trauma. Aaron would and Katie would relate to this very much from Jewish history of persecution and anti-Semitism. You try to not describe the situation too much because that will give them a PTSD. They'll need to see a therapist. So I try to describe it superficially and with as little detail as possible to give an image of what's happening there without going into graphic details. And then that guy got very touched. He was highly sympathetic. And that's why he said this statement out of personal concern. He is saying that the suffering in Gaza is genuine. He believes it. He feels in pain about it. He's anguished by it, but that it's Hamas's fault because they do not want to end the war, that Hamas wants the war to continue. And the other maddening thing is when every day I read Israeli newspapers as a daily habit, part of my work as well. I started to read every single one of them since October 7th, twice a day, in the morning and the evening, the Hebrew ones. There's 16 of them. It's very painful, not because of the content, but because of how immensely boring and tedious and painfully descriptive it is. You have to read the same thing over and over again. And what was the most baffling is how Israeli media is daily naming and shaming Netanyahu. And you don't see any trace of that in mainstream media whatsoever. That even when I sent it to journalists and correspondents from different newspapers, and I say, look, just translated word for word. It's in Israel Hayom, which is owned by Miriam Adelson, Sheldon Adelson's widow, who is very pro-Netanyahu, translated word for word, and they can't. There's an editorial decision not to. It's insane.
As we're speaking, the Israeli government is still not committing to implementing the ceasefire. Netanyahu has delayed a vote on it from his cabinet. And you have Israeli officials, including Ambassador Danny Danon, the Israeli ambassador to the UN, saying that Hamas is trying to engage in blackmail to force through provisions that were not agreed on. Do you know what he's talking about? And what do you make, you know, at this point of this Israeli refusal to fully commit to what everyone seems to think is a done deal?
Basically, I don't think he knows what he's talking about himself. There was an earlier interview that I watched with a Netanyahu spokesperson in London on Sky News, and the interviewer asked him, okay, so what is it exactly that Hamas is trying to change the last minute? And he literally answers this. He says, I cannot tell you the details. I cannot reveal what they're trying to change. But I'm telling you, the statement came out of Netanyahu's office. Take it at face value. Hamas is trying to change something. That was the essence of his argument. He doesn't know himself. He didn't know. And that's the same for Danny Danon, a slime bowl that gives slime bowls bad name. So basically for this guy, what Netanyahu is trying to do in the very last minute is to rewrite the agreement on two very substantial clauses. One of them is concerning the Philadelphia corridor. This is the area, if you control it, you basically seal Gaza off from the rest of the world. That's the area that is between Rafah and Egypt. It's where humanitarian aid is supposed to flow into Gaza from, where people are supposed to depart Gaza for medical treatment from. That's where the Rafah border crossing is in. If Israel maintains its presence there, it gets a final say on who goes in, who goes out. It can ban journalists from going in. It can do all sorts of things. So Netanyahu, in the agreement, it said that Israel would reduce the presence of IDF soldiers in the Philadelphia corridor throughout the first 42 days. By day 50, Israel would have completely left Philadelphia. There would not be any Israeli installations or soldiers there or any military presence. So Netanyahu is now saying another thing. He's saying, no. We never said there will be any reduction of forces. There is going to be a redeployment. We will keep all the installations. We will just reshuffle the locations of soldiers in that corridor, but every single one of them will stay there. And he says, no, we are not going to leave Philadelphia by day 50. We will stay there. And then he adds another condition, which is to say there is not going to be a ceasefire. That's the second condition he wants Hamas to agree to. His condition is basically that there will be a transition to phase two only if Hamas agrees to achieving the war objectives that Israel has set on October 7th. What are those war objectives? The full destruction of Hamas. So basically what he wants Hamas to sign on is to accomplish the mission that the IDF itself has failed to accomplish over 15 months of genocide. He wants Hamas to surrender, capitulate, bend the knee, break the sword, hand over everything in Gaza, and say, okay, take us to our own fate, lock us up in mass, incarcerate every single last member of us. That's basically what he wants. In that verbatim quote of saying the achievement of the war objectives, as well as dismantling the local government that is keeping Gaza alive at the moment. So the only misfortune for Netanyahu is that he expects that none of us got a hold of the deal itself, of the text that they signed. But the deal was leaked yesterday in Israeli media, in Arab media, in English media. You can see it all over the place. The actual papers that were signed with the shadow of the person, I think it's a Hamas leader, Hamas negotiator, holding a camera to take a picture of it. Some of the documents that were viewed by DropSite, for example, they had the stamps of Hamas as well as the signatures of every single Hamas negotiator. They just wanted to put all their names to make sure this is going to be the final deal. And Netanyahu now wants to convince you that that deal does not exist. Let's renegotiate the very final arrangements that would destroy the essence of the deal itself.
You've compared the deal that was presented in May to this recent deal, right? What is the difference?
Yeah, I was in a discussion yesterday with a colleague. He got a hold of the deal, the text at the same time as I got it, but it was in Arabic and he spoke English, so he didn't understand it. And he said, is there any way to help? So I started reading through it and I looked up the May 27th deal. I read the whole text word for word, identical, 100%, not a change. There's only an appendix of elaborations. And this contains 8 points. 6 of them are actual arguments, 2 just refer to the May 27th deal. And the 6 are about, one of them is about Philadelphia. One is about, because it was not presented in the May 27th deal, Israel did not occupy it at the time. So one of them was about Philadelphia, and one of them, basically an elaboration, one of them was about prisoners and the key of how many hostages will be released. And one update that incriminates Israel completely of saying that they will release 1,000 Gazans that were captured since October 8th that played zero role in October 7th, had no role in it whatsoever, which means innocent Gazans that Israel has been holding as a bargaining chip. In other words, hostages, 1,000 hostages. So basically, that's the update in the appendix. Otherwise, zero changes, 100% identical.
So all the blood, I mean, all the people who have been killed since then, it's been unnecessary, right? Like all the blood is on the hands of the people who refuse to engage in this deal, which would be not Hamas, but Netanyahu and basically, effectively, the United States.
Yeah, precisely. But even earlier than that, there's an Israeli journalist that I know. He's called Khaviv Gur. He works for the Times of Israel. He posted something on October 12th, 2023. A message he got from someone in Gaza in which that Palestinian says that what you're doing in Gaza is a crime. You're going to wipe it out completely. But by the end of this, after you've done all of this, Hamas, you will leave us with Hamas still in charge. Hamas will still be there. So they knew. Israeli politicians knew. American diplomats, experts, politicians, they all knew that at the end of this, this is what's going to happen. But as one American former diplomat put it to me, basically, like the essence of how he put it, he tried to put it in diplomatic terms, but the essence is let Israel smash some few things, let them get the rage out of their system, burn a few things down. He basically said, if we suffered a similar attack, we would want to burn the enemy down. So let Israelis do it. That was the essence of the argument to my face of saying that this is destruction for the sake of destruction, burning for the sake of burning, because of pure bloodlust and vindictiveness, vengefulness, nothing more. There's nothing that's going to come out of this. Some former American officials were telling us behind closed doors that they do not want de-Ba'athification. That's a term that comes from Iraq, in which the U.S. tried to dismantle the government of Saddam completely, and it led to disaster. They said, no, this should not be the way forward in Gaza. But at the same time, let Israel have its way. Destroy it to get it out of the system, nothing more.
When you're a military occupier and the occupied population resists in a
harmful way, as is what happened on October 7th, because Israeli military sites were hit and then soldiers were killed and soldiers were taken captive. You just cannot tolerate that according to the logic of being a military occupier. And that's why, in terms of getting something out of its system, Israel doesn't carry out just a few attacks in Gaza, but has sustained a more than year-long genocide. And that's what the U.S. has fully endorsed. When it comes to Hamas, do you think they want to stay in power inside Gaza? My sense of October 7th is that this was sort of just like a desperate last gasp, like that they felt they had no options left. The world had abandoned them. Gulf states were normalizing with Israel. When Palestinians in Gaza tried nonviolence with the Great March of Return, they were gunned down. And that maybe this was Hamas saying they don't care about staying in power anymore because they were basically being asked to rule over a besieged territory de facto on Israel's behalf. And that's at least what some people in Hamas didn't want to do. What is your sense of that? Like, do you think Hamas wants to stay in power inside Gaza, or would they accept some new form of leadership in that territory?
Oh, that's an excellent question. But one last thought on the previous issue. One message that Europeans and Americans keep telling us behind closed doors is Israelis are a traumatized people. They're in a state of trauma because of October 7th. You have to understand they're a traumatized nation that justifies everything they're doing. That was basically the essence of it. In terms of Hamas, there's twofold. On October 7th itself, and what is the form or shape that they see Gaza into on the day after. In the day after, I would say Hamas is now at a point where they themselves say anyone should come and take over Gaza in terms of governance, service provision, even security. They say we're open to anyone coming and taking over, as long as it's not someone coming on the back of an Israeli tank or parachuted by the Americans. It should be something that Palestinians choose. So there's a number of different proposals or formulas that they've been discussing with the Egyptians, with the Qataris and the Palestinian authorities and other Palestinians as well, even Dahlan, Mohammed Dahlan in the Emirates. One of these formulas is basically a national unity government where Hamas is not part of it, but Hamas, that government should be endorsed by every single Palestinian faction to have full legitimacy. There is another idea of forming an independent technocratic committee to be in charge of Gaza. That's a proposal that the Egyptians have been pushing. So that entity or committee is having on board or is headed by a number of academics, experts that are politically non-affiliated business people from Gaza or the West Bank or both. And they would run the government with the civil servants in place from both the local government and the Palestinian authorities government. And Hamas agreed to this. The Egyptians, the entire Arab world, Gulf countries, European Union, Trump's team agreed to it. Israel might tolerate it because it dances around Netanyahu's veto that the Palestinian Authority should not go back to Gaza and Hamas should not rule Gaza and UNRWA should not run Gaza, which basically means that he wants Gaza to be in a permanent state of chaos. The plan is to have no plan. But the signal that they got is that Israel would tolerate it. They did not get any definitive answer. Mahmoud Abbas rejected it, and he refused to engage with this scenario for a number of reasons. Some are cynical, some are logical. For example, he is worried that this is going to be a succession attempt at deposing him. There is this element of paranoia. That's the core of his whole fight with Mohammed Dahlan is this. He was worried that Dahlan is going to succeed and take over, or Salam Fayyad is going to take over. That's why he's sort of getting rid of them one after the other, any potential competitor. There was another element of fear that this independent committee in Gaza will get its own independent funding, which means the PA will not be able to take some of it for the West Bank, or it would not be sort of, they will not be able to siphon off some of, skim the top off. There's other concerns that are more logical in terms of Palestinian aspirations. For instance, there's the concern that this committee is apolitical. It does not have any sort of popular mandate. It's not endorsed by the public. If it takes over Gaza, and it's not going to talk anything about two state or one state, doesn't have that kind of mandate. It's just a service provider. And Trump allows Israel to annex major chunks of the West Bank, which means collapsing the Palestinian Authority. The center of gravity would be Gaza. And the entity in Gaza that is there speaking on behalf of Palestinians is an apolitical one. There's no Palestinian Authority or PLO, which means just replacing this entire paradigm with just Palestinian collaborators providing services to police the occupation and maintain it. So that was the concern. The other thing with October 7th, there is a personal element about Sinwar, Yahya Sinwar, who launched it. My sources, interviews, looking into it, reading reports, following it up very closely, my impression is that it was just a personal decision that he took with two other people, and that was about it. Muhammad Al-Daif, Marwan Isa, did not consult Ismail Haniyeh, any of the leadership abroad or even inside Gaza. Before October 7th, he knew that he's moving towards a throw of the dice, something that might shake up the state, not shake, something that would destroy the status quo, destroy it with a sledgehammer, or something that would lead to a disaster. But basically, what got him to that point is believing that everything that was tried before led to nowhere, including armed resistance. You had voices in Hamas like Saleh Haruri, the second in command after Ismail Haniyeh, saying in a leaked phone call that armed resistance displayed heroic examples, but it failed to produce results. Every time it goes through the same motion. Basically, as a former member of Knesset put it to me at some point, she said that she learned it by experience of decades. When Palestinians fire rockets, only then they get attention. As soon as the rockets stop, Gaza disappears completely, Palestine disappears completely. But Hamas learned that even then, the attention they get is merely directed at containing and silencing, pacifying, but not solving. So for Sinwar, he wanted to shatter the status quo. And the other element why he, the indication of like how he moved towards it, he just took the decision for October 7th, less than a month before it happened. Basically, as you said, the feeling that everything else does not work, the world has moved on, Gaza is completely forgotten, Palestine is completely forgotten. The years 2022 and 2023 were the bloodiest in the West Bank recorded history. And Biden did not even bat an eye. A top European leader that I met, he said that when he got his job in 2019, that will give an indication of who he is. Basically, he said that when he got his job, his advisors, his directors, his staff, his cabinet members said, don't bother at all with the Israeli-Palestinian topic. It exhausted itself. You're going to burn yourself out. You're going to burn a lot of political capital. It's not worth it. Move on. There are other urgent issues. People there are alive. They're not getting killed every day. They can survive. They can manage. They will figure it out. And he said he complied. He did. He turned his face the other way around until a few months before October 7th, and then October 7th hit him in the face. So there was that very clear signal in Gaza, as well as the expansion of normalization to include Saudi Arabia. This whole Abraham Accords paradigm, Daniel Levy would have been better equipped to comment on it. He's very eloquent on dismantling it in very succinctly. But it is designed at the very core of it to aggressively push Palestinians into complete irrelevancy and obsolescence. If you listen to speeches by Trump's administration or Biden's administration, one thing that they have in common is saying, don't worry about the Palestinian topic. It's not the most urgent or the biggest topic in the Middle East. They are a very minor fractional issue on the sidelines. They're not at the heart of the conflict. Building relations between Israel and Arab countries, that is what's at the heart of the conflict. That is a unanimous message that you hear also from Blinken in his speech today, I think, at the State Department. So for Sinwar, there was another element. People in Gaza, young people in particular, started to take their own lives. Basically, the idea of suicide crossed the minds of virtually everyone I know. And there are two ways to do it. There is the taking your own life in the most humiliating way and being remembered as a person who committed suicide in a society that is culturally religious, that sees suicide as a gateway to eternity in hell. So you can only think of the mentality that Israel has pushed Gazans into, that suicide and God's hell, no matter how frightening it is, people have been forced to believe that it's going to be way better than the hell that Gaza has become. The other way is just to either try to stir trouble, resist, fight back, throw projectiles on Israel, or even just go and stand at the fence, at the primary fence between Gaza and Israel. If you look at the record on October 6th, Israel was still killing Palestinians in Gaza. All they had to do was just go and stand at the fence. Just stand there and wait for Israeli sharpshooters to knock them down, to take their lives for sport. They were bragging about it. There was an article about 42 knees in one day. If you read it, it's insane that a human can come up with this sort of convoluted level of evilness. That one soldier says that his co-sniper, the spotter, the one with the binoculars, was sad that he didn't shoot any knees, whereas this soldier shot 42 in one day of nonviolent protesters. So he says at the end of it, I felt pity towards him, and I didn't want other soldiers to bully him for it. So I decided to switch roles with this soldier and let him shoot a few knees, cripple a few Palestinians permanently. So even Hamas's own family members started to desert and leave Gaza, either go stand at the borders and get shot. Some of Ismail Haniyeh's own kids went to the borders, and one of them was wounded in the neck with a bullet. Some of them left Gaza. Some of them deserted Hamas completely and went to refugee camps in Turkey, in Europe, in Greece, and other areas. So basically, Gaza was collapsing completely, a collapse of organized human life in it, people at each other's throats. Sinwar, in all of this, I'm not trying to justify, I'm trying to explain, but in all of this, he decides to send people, Hamas's top leaders, out of Gaza about, I think, 10 days before October 7th. That was Bassem Naim, Ghazi Hamad, Nizar Awadallah, Kamal Abu Aoun, and others. And he tells them, you're going to Turkey to attend a conference, and you're going to come back. And that's it. You just go for a few days, you're coming back. He didn't inform any of them. That's why they left their families behind. A lot of them still have their families in Gaza. Some of them lost family members. So basically, he sends them off. Ironically, he asked for someone to send back to Gaza. He says, there is a Hamas leader called Fathi Hamad. He's in Turkey. Him and Sinwar never got along well. They had a fight in his last days, and Sinwar pushed him out of Gaza. He had to leave. He was given his passport and forced to leave Gaza to Turkey. And Hamad is known as the most sort of, excuse my French, but the guy that always fucks up Palestinians rhetorically. He gives Israel one gift after the other with the most imbecilic rhetorics. So in one speech, he says, there's no such thing as Palestinians. We're all Saudis, Egyptians, Jordanians. Palestine doesn't exist. We're your brothers and sisters. Take care of us. An idiot, a schmuck. In another speech, he calls on Palestinians and Arabs abroad to go after Jews, not Israelis. Even Hamas themselves, they condemned him for that anti-Semitic remark. They had to issue a statement distancing themselves from him. So basically, Sinwar says, send me that guy back to Gaza. All of you leave, but send me Fathi Hamad. He wanted to get rid of him along with himself going down. And did that throw of the dice to see where it goes. As Norman Finkelstein, that you hosted before, said, Sinwar lived his entire life in prison, a man of limited mental range. He'd never saw a world outside of Gaza itself. So of all the options around him, that seemed like the option that he was destined to take. And I conclude with one sentence. I asked that top European official, I told him, okay, you have a lot of experience, decades. You've been a diplomat for your entire life. Give me a recommendation. What should we do as Palestinians? What should Hamas do? What should the Palestinian Authority do? And I promise I'll take your advice word for word and give it to them as it is. I will spread it everywhere. What should Palestinians do? The first two times, he skipped a question, although it was a lunch arrangement, so face-to-face. The third time, he basically resigned back in his chair, collapsed in very visible anguish and despair, and started to stutter. He struggled to articulate one sentence. He was like, they tried, it didn't work. And then he says, I don't know what Palestinians can do. I don't know. I really don't know what they can do. They tried everything. I don't know. And he keeps mindlessly repeating, I don't know. I don't know. And that's how it ends in the discussion with him.
Mohammed, how are your friends? You're from Gaza. How are your friends and family? Tell us about how this has impacted the people in your life.
Well, basically, I think a lot of them are no longer with us now. And each time I receive the news of any of them getting murdered, the most devastating element of it is basically that they died before they ever experienced living. My closest friend, Ali Adam, he was killed on January 10th, 2024. An airstrike directly hit in the head The only pictures or footage I have of him is his passport picture, his mugshot from an article he wrote, and the video of his body, lifeless body, for 3 seconds being carried to a hospital with his head being split in two. The most painful thing about his death was not the suffering of it, was not the horrors he endured in his last days or displacement or any of these tribulations. It was basically the things that keeps me up at night is that he never got a chance to live. So every time I experience any element of life, get good food, go on a nice walk in nature, I remember him immediately, that he literally, his life ended before he even lived it. And that was a daily topic of discussion for him and I, his daily struggles to come out of Gaza or his daily struggles to make a living in Gaza itself. And neither was working. In like, even when the war started, he was very close to getting out. Very, very close. He was supposed to go to Italy to do a master's. He applied for the visa. The visa officer did not see him as human enough. She said that the student insurance he submitted was $50 cheaper than the requested one, $50. So she held his passport for 2 weeks extra. The war started. No passport. He cannot get out anyways, and then murdered. Basically, the most painful thing is he never got a chance to live, but he never got a chance to be known as well. I don't have anyone to mourn him with. And then last week, I got the news of another very close friend of mine, a friend that we went to school together, childhood friend, Khalil Prit, a medical doctor, physician, who was murdered in exactly the same way. A rocket directly hit him next to the Shifa Hospital and split his head in two. His brain was exposed. He was being treated in an ICU unit, and then no medication, no anesthesia, nothing is left, succumbed to his wounds. And Khalil, I can say he got a little more experience of life, not any better than Gaza, because he went to study in Sudan's countryside to become a doctor, lived through the coup, the revolution, the civil war, and persisted and went to Gaza, decided to stay there, only to be killed in a direct airstrike on him. And I can go on with a long list of lots of loved ones, family, and friends that were just killed so senselessly. And each single one of them I know by heart had nothing to do with Hamas. Not that this condemns them or deems them legitimate targets, but had nothing to do with Hamas. Ali, he was extremely critical of Hamas in every way possible. Khalil as well. Murdered one after the other. But that's when it hit me, when the ceasefire was announced. I had this immediate relief of like a feeling of a mountain being lifted off your chest. But then immediate pain taking over instead. Because once the music is off, once the bombardment is off, that's when you have all the time in the world and all the mental capacity to process what it actually means for Ellie to be dead, or for your home to be gone, or for the homes of every single member of your family and every single person that you know in Gaza to be fully destroyed. And to lose, like, everyone I know has lost family members in the dozens. The last figure that I counted was 35 or 34 of my own family. And that was in February last year. I couldn't cope with it. I couldn't keep a count anymore. I just decided not to keep a count. So basically, as soon as the ceasefire was announced, I took my phone out, went through the names on my contact list, and literally tried one name after the other to call. And that's when it was hitting me incrementally, is that most of the people that I know in Gaza, most of my loved ones, are either dead, missing, or unreachable. I couldn't get a hold of anyone. And that's when worry immediately took over after that anxiousness. Because on four grounds, there is the anxiousness that until the ceasefire is implemented, Israel will escalate and accelerate the killing and destruction. In Gaza, whenever there is any rumors of a ceasefire, whenever there are any rounds of negotiations, Gazans call it revenge days. The IDF goes on a killing spree, kills people in the hundreds. So since the ceasefire was announced, about, I think, 100 Gazans were killed, 200 were wounded. So basically, that's the main concern. There's a sub-concern in it that Israel might kill a hostage in that killing spree, especially if it's one of the high-profile ones, for example, the female soldiers that were captured from the Nahal Oz military base. If any of them is killed, Netanyahu, you will immediately expect he will blame it on Hamas. He will say Hamas executed them because they've been raping them, because they impregnated them. And he will try to exploit the shock to destroy the ceasefire. Today, the Hamas declared in a statement that one Israeli airstrike hit a location where a female captive was being held and did not reveal the fate of that captive. But you can see that major risk. There's the other concern is that there's not going to be a phase two. It's phase one and that's it. And a temporary pause, the last pause that was in Gaza in November, December 2023, it did way more damage than it did good to people there, because it gave them plenty of time to absorb the shock, to understand what the true magnitude of what unfolded. And then when Israel resumed the war, they resumed it a thousandfold as viciously. And the sort of the other concern that I have is basically one of the main ones, and the last one is, as soon as the war ends, Gaza will be pushed into complete irrelevancy, a total full blackout, like it never even existed. The whole world will pretend that nothing ever happened there. Let's move on. You saw that with Iraq, people saying, why are you stuck with Iraq? Move on. It's old news now. It's history. That's why you see now mainstream media daring to be a little bit more critical of Israel than before. CBS with the 60-minute documentary where they show footage that they kept secret for 8 months, and they only show it now because they know there is a ceasefire. So there are no consequences to revealing this information. Or Israel, as soon as Gaza disappears, they will just simply ban cement and reconstruction material from going in and keep it as a death camp, a concentration camp, where you have two options: stay and die of starvation, disease, and cold, or leave and never look back.
I'm so sorry, Mohammed. It's so heartbreaking and infuriating and upsetting, and I can't stand the fact that our government helped fund this. And I can't really imagine what you're going through, but it's, to the extent that I can, it's so unfair. Words kind of like fail. I don't even know, but it's just, yeah, I'm so sorry to everyone who's lost people there.
Thank you. It means a lot.
Mohammed Shahada, writer and analyst from Gaza. Thank you so much for sharing your insight with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate all the great work you're doing.
Well, both of those interviews were extremely informative. And I have to say, hearing Mohammed talk about what's happened to his friends and family really like brings home the consequences of all of this policy, these wars, these decisions that, you know, literally just result in the death, maiming, suffering of people.
That's the legacy that the Biden administration is leaving behind. And we'll see, with Trump taking credit now for the ceasefire, whether he'll do anything different. It remains to be seen. I'm not giving Trump any credit until actually a ceasefire is implemented by Israel, which Israel so far is refusing to do. And of course, we'll have to see what happens to Gaza. And it's not a case where just because you have a ceasefire, everyone packs up and goes home, everything's resolved. No. You still have a territory that's been destroyed. You still have the people that are living under the world's worst military occupation. And it's just a basic fundamental requirement for anything sustainable that be addressed. And the Trump administration has given no indication so far that it plans to put any pressure on Israel beyond this potential role they had in the ceasefire agreement. And so if that's the case, then this issue, even if there's no active genocide going on, will still be just as salient, just as important for the world.
Right. Thank you guys again so much for watching, and we will see you next week under a new president.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
At
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.